Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome back to the New Books Network African American Studies podcast. Today, I will talk with sociologist Dr. Sean Drake, who is the author of Academic Apartheid, Race and the Criminalization of Failure in an American Suburb. I'm your host, Mikhail Carter. Dr. Sean Drake, it is great to have you on. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
I am so glad that you're here. So I want to really talk to you about your amazing work. So one thing that really drew me to your book was the title, Academic Apartheid. And so I have experience in education. And so it was a Title I school, predominantly Black student body. And so I really was interested in your title along with like the American suburb and pretty much the opposite of my teaching experience. So could you please talk to the audience about your title and pretty much what were you getting at?
Yeah. So the title was a process that took, a couple of years to kind of settle on. But essentially, I think for a title, I think one thing I did, kind of when I was in school and new books would, be assigned in a class or I would, check something out, maybe creating my own summer reading list. I always would pay attention to the titles. The title is what would sort of catch my attention. If the title was interesting, then I was more likely to, maybe want to see what the book was about or read further. So I wanted a title that would be somewhat kind of, that would be, a little bit provocative, that would grab people's attention, but at the same time would be truthful to the book and to the work, that would be accurate and an accurate representation of what the book is about. And so, I thought about different titles, and really what I was kind of sticking on was the word apartheid and whether that word was an appropriate word to use in this context and for the data that I had for the book. Academic apartheid had a nice ring to it, but was it really apartheid, what I was describing? And, apartheid is really a process of segregation and social isolation that's very vivid, that's very stark, that's almost absolute, sort of like a Jim Crow situation. These are kind of synonymous things. And the situation that I describe in the book is one in which students are segregated to two separate schools that are very different in many, many ways. The physical space of the schools, the curriculum, the racial and socioeconomic composition of the student body, the privileges that students have, the relationship between police and the institution and other law enforcement officials, the post-secondary opportunities that graduates have. And so it struck me that the experiences and the kind of places and spaces were so starkly different you know, that the word apartheid was in fact appropriate, especially when taking into account the kind of racial and socioeconomic disparity between the two schools that I detail in the book. And then, you know, it's a book about schools and about academics, and so academic made sense. And then I kind of put those two words together. But I certainly, you know, went through several titles, and at one point I had settled on a different title, and I was talking to somebody and they said, no, don't do that. So yeah, that was a title that I had. And then it was just about making sure that the word apartheid really fit what I'm describing in the book.
For sure. And it's a very fitting title. I do agree. And so you spoke about like the experiences of students in your book. And so I would like to talk to you briefly about your own personal experiences. You mentioned at the opening of the book, you talked about growing up in San Francisco in your childhood. So how did your early experiences help to influence your research?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question, because my childhood experiences and kind of some of my, you know, experiences in young adulthood, you know, had a profound influence, you know, kind of on my life and certainly on this book. I grew up in San Francisco. And San Francisco is an interesting place. You know, it's a very, you know, it's a progressive city. It's very liberal. It's very diverse in terms of, you know, people of all backgrounds living there. But at the same time, it has elements of income inequality that are really striking. It has elements of residential racial segregation that are really striking. It has kind of a stratified public education system where some schools are considered to be really good and others are considered to be not so good. And the schools that are considered to be not so good tend to have more Black and Brown students in them. And so even though it's one of the more progressive major cities in the country, obviously in the West Coast and that region and all of that, and it's sort of known for that, it still has many of these elements of inequality and disparity that you would see in cities across the country. And that was something that I realized as a young age. You know, I was fortunate to attend schools where I had plenty of resources. The schools that were well-funded, schools where I had lots of opportunities to pursue the things that I wanted to, to sort of brighten my future and give me that chance. And one thing I noticed when I was probably sometime in middle school, I really started to notice that a lot of people that looked like me, that looked like I did not have those opportunities. And typically those are my friends and family outside of school. You know, I was always one of very few Black or Brown students at any school that I attended. But then on weekends when I would hang out with, my friends and family, I would see that they often didn't have the same opportunity. And those would be people who looked like me. And so I wondered why, you know, why is it that schools with all the Black and Brown students don't have, you know, they didn't have the facilities that my school had. They didn't have the, the two-story library that my school had. They didn't have the new gym, and they didn't have all of these things. They didn't have the outdoor education program. They didn't have all of these, enrichment activities. Why was that? That didn't seem fair to me. And so I think that was something that really stuck with me. And it really seemed like, you know, there were these students who, I sort of shared these experiences with of sort of, you know, being kind of a person of color in America who were disadvantaged through no fault of their own. You know, it wasn't their fault that they lived where they lived, or that they went to the school where they went to. And that really made a big impression on me. And that was something that really stuck with me. And as I got further along in school and got more into the literature in my psychology and my sociology classes, I saw that there just wasn't, students like me weren't really represented in the literature very much. You know, students who were maybe the only Black kid in their class or the only Black Brown student in their class or one of very few in their grade level. You know, we weren't really in the narrative when we were talking about kind of racial inequality and segregation and disparity in schools. And so I wanted to sort of, you know, fill those gaps in some ways. There were also things that happened to me, you know, things that teachers would say to me or my peers would say to me about my accomplishments, you know, that sort of rubbed me the wrong way when I was a kid, but I didn't really know how to deal with them or what it meant. And so those were things that, you know, I had, you know, research questions about and was sort of able to pursue and address more in this book. So in some ways, this book is a chance for me to explore kind of who I was in my childhood and some of that sort of inequality, you know, inequality that's happening, you know, in different spaces beyond the sort of, you know, beyond, you know, what was kind of been represented most often in the literature up to this point.
For sure. Thank you for that. And so I really love what you said there as far as, and then, so this project is like a personal piece for you, right? Because it's like,
No, absolutely. It's very personal. And I think, you know, I think as a researcher, I think that's, you know, like I encourage my students to lean into who they are as people. You know, there's a saying we have in ethnography, which is as a research method, which is just to start where you are, which means that that can mean in terms of, you know, where you're doing your investigation, but also it just means in terms of, you know, who you are as a person, the things that you care about. And I think, I think that sometimes research can be the most impactful, the most interesting, when it's something that we do care about, and we sort of, there is that passion, you know, in the work. And so for me, certainly, you know, I like to ask questions about and investigate things that are things that I care about outside of a research context. I care about these things, you know, personally as well.
Right. I love that. And so speaking of ethnography, please, like, so we know that this book is an ethnographic study, right? And you're conducting this ethnographic field work. And so I'm not going to lie, I had to go to Google and type in, you know, what is ethnography? So if you could please explain, tell us what ethnographic fieldwork is, and just talk to us about your sources.
Yes. So ethnography and ethnographic fieldwork are, you know, that's something that I came to relatively late. You know, when I started graduate school, I didn't know what it was. I'm glad that I discovered it sometime along the way, because it is a research method, a method of data collection analysis. It's widely practiced in anthropology, but also in sociology and in other social science disciplines as well. It is essentially the systematic study of culture, typically the culture of a place or a community, and the people who live there. And as ethnographers, what we try to do is we try to apprehend and render people's lived experiences, the things that they do in their lives, how they make it through their days, how they make meaning of the things that happened, how they perceive different things that go on, and how they make decisions based upon kind of the frame through which they view events and things that happen in their lives. And those are very context dependent. So, for example, the same event that happens in neighborhood A might not mean the same thing as if it happens in neighborhood B. And so that's something that as ethnographers, we try to understand, and how people make meaning of their experiences and then how they act on those perceptions. And so that means as a method that we have to spend a lot of time with people and in communities, getting to know them, building relationships, hanging out. People watching, you know, taking field notes. We also interview people at length. We have informal conversations with people. Sometimes if we want to understand a neighborhood, we rent an apartment in the neighborhood so that we can really immerse ourselves. So it's a very immersive method in that way. And it typically takes months, if not years, to collect all of the data necessary to complete an ethnographic project. And we call this our field work. So we go out into the field and we collect our data. And so it's a time-intensive process. We have to code our data, meaning we have to like attach labels to our notes based on different themes and patterns that we see. We do the same thing with our interviews, which we typically record if we can, and then transcribe the interviews. So it's a really lengthy process, but it's an inductive process. We use inductive reasoning, meaning that we know what we know because we've observed it firsthand, or we've heard it directly from the source. And so, or it's been directly observed by somebody whom we speak to. So, you know, it's rigorous in that way. And, you know, there are lots of complications that can arise, right? We have to be in the space. So we are kind of a part of the research. Sometimes that can get tricky with people who may not want us there, or maybe it's a private space. You know, let's say we wanted to do a project about the people's home life, the family home life in a neighborhood. You can't just knock on someone's door and walk into their living room and sit down for 3 or 4 hours and do that a few times a week for a year. You know, that would take a significant amount of negotiation and building of rapport. So depending on the setting, there is that period of kind of finessing and rapport and building trust with people. And so it takes a long time. And for that reason, it's really not for everyone. But, you know, for me, it's the method that I enjoy. You know, I enjoy asking those sorts of questions, kind of how things happen and why they happen, that necessitate this sort of a method. So, you know, that's what ethnography is. And so, you know, our sources, we typically call them informants. And these are typically people who live in the neighborhood who we're interested in. Sometimes people who you don't think are going to have pertinent information end up having really important information. And also, you know, we don't have hypotheses. So sometimes we don't know what we're going to find or really fully what we're interested in. We may just have general ideas. And then we go and we hang out and things emerge from our field work. And then that takes us in a new direction. So the method can be very exciting that way. And we have to kind of keep an open mind to what we're going to find. But that's essentially what ethnography is. And, you know, it has a really rich tradition in sociology. And I employed those methods for this book, and I tried to kind of take my cues and my example from other, you know, similar ethnographic works of schools and other community spaces. And so that's that. I think that's kind of the gist of what ethnographic research is.
Thank you for that. And so, as far as your research, could you talk to us about your research when it comes to like? How did those teachers, because you went into these two schools, right? Pinnacle High School and then Crossroads High School. And so you were there for what, months? And really immersing yourself within like the school setting. So could you talk to us about that? What reactions did you get? Were from the teachers, students, administration, parents? And then also like, were they familiar with your research as well?
Yeah, it's a great question because so much of this sort of research requires you to gain access to your field sites and, you know, not just for a day or for an hour or two, but sometimes for months or even years. You know, I spent, you know, the better part of 2.5 years in and out of these schools and, you know, several times a week, sometimes, you know, a few hours at a time. So that process usually starts with identifying a field site. In this case, I identified Pinnacle High School early on because it was this flagship public high school with, you know, lots of really high achieving students. And there just weren't that many, you know, Black or Latinx students at the school. And so for me, that was a space to try to understand those students' experiences living in a community like this, you know, a suburban community like this in suburban Southern California. Going to a school like this. And so, you know, I sent emails to administrators telling them who I was, what I was interested in, you know, why I thought their school would be a good fit for my project. I think I said some flattering things about their school, which were true, you know, just sort of talking about how their school was really well respected and had this, you know, this kind of academic profile that was sort of the envy of other schools in the district and in the region even. And I had this interesting situation where at that school, I remember an assistant principal responding to me and saying, okay, you can come on campus for a couple hours a day, or, you know, for a couple hours, you know, for a couple weeks. So, you know, that was going to be like 4 total hours of time on campus, you know, which might not have been enough for a term paper, let alone a dissertation and eventually a book. And eventually I was able to gain much more access once he agreed to send my email around to the teachers. And once a couple of teachers were on board, then this assistant principal was like, okay, if the teachers are on board and say it's okay for you to come hang out in classrooms, then I'm okay with that. So once his teachers were on board with me coming and hanging out, then he was fine with it. So that process took, you know, a few weeks kind of waiting to hear back and forth and getting the necessary approvals from the university just to kind of do this sort of a project. And then, you know, for the first few weeks of kind of going and hanging out in classrooms, I was just in one classroom, and then those students would kind of get to know me. And, you know, I didn't do any interviews because I wanted people to kind of get to know my face on campus. And then over time, I expanded the classrooms and the different kind of departments, because the school was, you know, it had like a history department and a math department. So I would kind of expand to hang out in different departments, in different classrooms, always like with a referral from one teacher to another. So they would sort of know who I was. And by a certain point, you know, I was going to different events on campus so people would recognize my face. And then eventually I let teachers know that I wanted to do some interviews with them and with students. And so they announced that to their classrooms, and there were, you know, students were really interested and wanted to help out. And I'm really thankful to them and to the teachers and parents for their, you know, for accepting me onto the campuses. But that process took, you know, a few months of me just kind of hanging out and letting them get to know me first. And also, you know, letting people know, hey, I'm not a reporter. You know, I'm not trying to write a hit piece, or I don't have the story already written. I'm really just trying to understand, you know, this school and kind of the academic culture and what goes on and what makes this school tick. And soon, you know, I found out about this other high school, Crossroads, and I found out about some of the disparities. And so then the project expanded to be a kind of a comparative study between the two schools. And then there was a process of kind of access to that site that was very similar. So so all of that took a few months. And then I used pseudonyms for all the names. So Pinnacle High School, Crossroads, Valley View, my name for the suburb, all the names of teachers, parents, students, administrators, other staff. Those are all pseudonyms just to protect people's, you know, privacy and confidentiality.
Sure. Thank you. And so could you talk to us about Pinnacle High School then? Because you have this comparative study. And so what did you find? What were your findings from Pinnacle High School? And really paint the picture, because it sounds like this, you know, beautiful campus. And then also discuss, you mentioned the culture of success for Pinnacle as well. So could you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, Pinnacle was an interesting, you know, really interesting school. You know, a large public high school, you know, ranked in the top 100 in the nation, you know, a campus that's got these like beautifully manicured lawns and the trees are pruned perfectly, and it's got different buildings and, you know, for, you know, the math, science, you know, language arts, you know, history, different, you know, social sciences has kind of got different buildings for different departments, you know, theater, gym, auditorium, Olympic size swimming pool, soccer field, you know, a baseball field that looks like, you know, a minor league team would play on it. I mean, just really, really, you know, beautiful facilities, 55 acres of facilities, tennis courts, all that stuff. So it looks like the type of suburban school that you'd see like on a TV show. You know, it really is that type of place. And there are, I think there are 29 honors and AP classes offered. the graduation rate is almost 100%. Over 70% of graduates go directly to four-year colleges and universities. Over 96% go on to some form of post-secondary education. So it's a college-going environment. It's a type of school where, you know, success means having a 4.0 GPA. Success means getting admitted to a, you know, a major research institution, you know, kind of a major respected, nationally renowned, internationally renowned college. And that's the that's kind of the mantra. So what that means is it's a very competitive academic environment. Students are competing. It's stressful. It's cutthroat. Students are staying up late to study. Students are taking multiple honors and AP classes at the same time. Students are talking about where they get into college and where their parents want them to go. So it's this really kind of lofty and exacting academic culture. And the problem with that is that it does produce a lot of stress. But also if you're a student who doesn't fit that profile, it can be a really alienating place. And I think, you know, in some ways it can be alienating even for the students who achieve a lot, who kind of live up to that, those definitions of achievement, because sometimes they don't feel like their achievements are really theirs. You know, sometimes they feel like they're just doing this because their parents want them to, or they don't like school. It's not fun, but they're working really hard because they feel like they have to do it. And so in some ways they're feeling alienation, but I think even more of that alienation comes from students who maybe don't want to go to college or maybe aren't achieving those sorts of grades, and maybe they don't want to put that much time into it because they have other interests, you know, and they want to enjoy other aspects of their youth. You know, they don't want to over, you know, do 10 things and be exhausted every day. And sometimes that puts them in a difficult position. So for example, there's a college sweatshirt day every spring, and I talk about this in the book, where students will wear apparel from the college that they've been accepted to. And this is a way for students to sort of show off their achievement. The school loves to take pictures, put it on their Facebook page, put it on Twitter, put it on other social media platforms to say, hey, our students graduate and go to this fancy school. Look how many students we have going to the Ivy League and other, you know, fancy places. And, you know, it can be sort of stressful for students because there's sort of this sort of comparison happening. Oh, you got into this school and I didn't, and I'm going over here or whatever. So that can be challenging, but also it can be especially challenging for students who aren't going to college or who maybe are going to the local community college. And so they don't want to participate in that. They don't want to wear those, you know, sweatshirts or t-shirts or whatever. But inevitably on those days, if they don't wear something, then they'll be asked, are you going to college? Where are you going? Where did you get in? And so that can sort of create, you know, these divisions. So this sort of academic culture really divides the school between students who are achieving at this very kind of exacting level of success and then everybody else who isn't. And you know, another point I would mention is that achievement is very much racialized at this school, meaning that there are these racial stereotypes at the school about who's supposed to be successful on those terms and who really isn't expected to be. And so, you know, in many cases, the Asian American students who were mostly, ethnic Koreans and Chinese, they were considered the students who were responsible for the school's academic reputation, for the high grades and test scores and graduation rates. You know, there were different sayings that would go around on campus about this, different jokes and stereotypes. And by the same token, I found that the Black and Brown students weren't expected to achieve that. And the white students were sort of somewhere in between. And so, achievement was very racialized, which meant that there were sort of these positive and negative racial stereotypes about different groups floating around, which I think, you know, affected the ways that teachers treated students, the ways that they talked to students, the alienation that the Black and Brown students often felt on this campus, and then, you know, they would try to kind of build community despite that. So it was really that type of a school, you know, somewhat unique in some ways, but also, you know, these sort of notions of achievement and what counts as success, and how an institution kind of, reifies or reproduces that inequality, the students who are left behind in that and alienated and sort of not helped. You know, Pinnacle would just kind of cater to the students who are already achieving really in a really high way and not help students who are struggling more. Instead, just push them out to Crossroads, treat Crossroads like a dumping ground. You know, that was something that I found in this district and that really does happen in other districts across the country as well. So while this is a really extreme case, which is kind of why I wanted to write a book about it, it is something that is widespread and happening in states and districts, you know, across the country.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
For sure. And then this is a very important book, I feel, because it's bringing things like this that's happening across the country kind of to light. And so like Pinnacle, it has this success rate and this is what our students are high achieving. This is what we believe. And so tell us then what happens if when you have students who they feel are not achieving at the level that they want to achieve. And then that goes into you start to discuss in your book these alternative education programs or these continuation schools. And so could you talk to us about what are these? What are alternative education programs and continuation schools?
So it's an important question. And I think, in terms of the kind of the Pinnacle side of things, the problem with their sort of institutional success frame, kind of the way that they define success as an institution, and that definition is supported by a lot of students and teachers and parents. The problem with that is that there's really only kind of one way to be successful at the school, and it requires you to attain these certain academic achievements that are a very, very high bar. And the problem with that, as you mentioned, is if you don't reach that level of success, especially if you fall, you know, some way short of that in some way, then you are alienated and marginalized, even to the point where you can be pushed out to this separate school. And so continuation schools, also called alternative schools, are, in this case, high schools that are part of the local public school district where students go if they've fallen off pace to graduate on time with their class. And usually this happens after students, you know, fail two courses in the same term, fail the same course twice, or even if their GPA dips below 2.0. In some districts, that can trigger a referral to be transferred to an alternative school. These are typically not disciplinary schools. So these are not schools where students go if they commit, or engage in illicit activity or commit a crime or something like that. Usually there are other facilities or other schools, where students are sent if they commit those sorts of infractions. But nevertheless, despite the fact that schools like Crossroads are not disciplinary schools, they often have features that, are very sort of carceral, they're sort of prison-like. So for example, at Crossroads, there's this like 8-foot metal fence that runs around the perimeter of the school. And that's not necessarily noteworthy. You know, a lot of schools have fences around them, but it's noteworthy for Crossroads because it's the only school in this district that has a fence like this. All the other high schools are just kind of wide open, grassy campuses. Crossroads has a lot of asphalt. It's got a fence around it. It's got these floodlights on poles for added surveillance. You know, like these big spotlights that they shine down on the courtyard. It's got a lot of asphalt. It's got these buildings with these sort of rectangular buildings with really low ceilings that look like trailers. So it's a very kind of stark, austere campus. They don't prune the grass outside, so it's kind of growing wildly. The bushes, the hedges in front are kind of dead or dying. There's not that sort of even care and investment in the property that you see at Pinnacle. And what was striking about this for me is that the schools are only about a half a mile apart and they're in the same suburb. It's not as if one of them is on the other side of the tracks or one of them is in this kind of neighborhood and the other one's in this kind of neighborhood. They're not. They're both in very similar, you know, kind of expensive, you know, affluent neighborhoods. And yet they're just very, very different, very, very different spaces. So that's the process. Transfer from Pinnacle to Crossroads is voluntary, but what I found was that administrators, teachers, counselors would put considerable pressure on students and families to get them to acquiesce to the transfer. So they would say things like, well, you'll fail if you stay at Pinnacle. Or they'll say things, and they would actually sometimes pressure them before they had kind of met that threshold. There was a sort of threshold of credit deficiency, is what they called it, that a student had to reach. And as I said, usually, you know, that was below a 2.0 or you fail a class or two. But they would sometimes pressure students who hadn't even reached that threshold. And many times parents and students would not want to transfer because they knew the reputation of Crossroads, or they would hear stereotypes and rumors about the school. Everybody's pregnant there. There's gangs. There's fights. There's smoke-filled bathrooms. Virtually none of that was true, but those were the stereotypes out there in the community, and those would kind of, you know, those were just in the air at Pinnacle or Valley View High School or any of the other high schools around in the district. And so students would know about this, and they would be really sometimes even distraught when they found out that they were being, you know, kind of pushed to that school. So and so typically it was the parents who had more resources who were able to resist and kind of push back and avoid the transfer. So they would put students in private tutoring, or they would pull a student out and put them in private school. And you know, those are expensive options and they're not available to everybody. And so that was where sort of the socioeconomic disparity came in. I think roughly 11% of students at Pinnacle were on, you know, qualified for free reduced price lunch. Just over 50% of Crossroads students did. So this, you know, you sort of had more of those socioeconomically disadvantaged students at Pinnacle or at Crossroads by roughly a factor of five. And in part, that was because there were many more, you know, many more of those families, you know, just weren't able to resist effectively and push back against the pressure. So that's the sort of dynamic that happened there. And, you know, alternative education programs, sometimes, you know, to be fair, sometimes they work really well. There were students at Crossroads who, you know, went there and, you know, the goal is to be able to recover credits to kind of get back on track and then transfer back to your comprehensive high school. So you go to Crossroads for a year or maybe two, and then you transfer back and graduate from Pinnacle. This happened sometimes, but and there were some students who might have dropped out had they not had Crossroads. However, only 17% of eligible students transferred back from Crossroads to Pinnacle. So often once students went to Crossroads, they typically would remain there. And that was because, you know, there was very little homework. The school day was short, so students would get out at noon and have nothing to do. You know, Crossroads had no sports, no clubs, no after-school program, no PTA, no library. So it was really just show up, do your packets, and leave. And a lot of students, There was more of a culture of academic apathy, as I call it in the book, at that school that would kind of suck students in. So students would arrive there, maybe be really motivated to leave, but then kind of get sucked into to this new reality. So that was really the dynamic, and that's sort of part of that apartheid, part of that segregation, especially when we consider the racial disparity, you know, between the two schools as well. And I think in general, the last thing I would say about this is that continuation schools are, in place at districts across the country. There are over 500,000 students who are enrolled in continuation schools nationally at any given time, roughly 90,000 of them in California alone. Kind of during the No Child Left Behind era, the number of students in continuation schools rose precipitously because it was a way for some of these public high schools to shirk accountability for educating all students and just pass them off to these continuation schools. And so, as I write out in the book, I think this is kind of a policy problem, and I have some ways of, some solutions to combat that. But that's the general gist of continuation schools and what they're all about and how they operate a little bit in this particular district.
For sure. Thank you. And then I know you spoke about some of these differences, but could you tell us about the racial demographics of Crossroads High Schools and also like this, I guess, culture of failure, for lack of better words, in comparison to Pinnacle, which had this culture of like achievement instead.
Yeah. So in terms of the racial disparity, and I think it's good to also think about this in the context of Valley View. So, Valley View is like a destination city. It's a city that people want to move to because it's got, sunny weather year round, and the public schools are well rated, and the crime rate is low, and it's kind of got all of those things. And so it's a destination city for East Asian immigrants. Roughly 50% of Valley View residents are Asian American, and it's no different at Pinnacle. And so roughly 52% of the Pinnacle High School student body identifies as Asian American. The majority of those are ethnic Koreans or Chinese. And then roughly 40% of the student body there, or just under, are white students, and then the remaining roughly 10% are Black and Latinx students. And those are similar percentages to Valley View overall, but the disparity really comes into play when we look at those numbers at Crossroads. So at Crossroads, roughly half of the student body identifies as Black or Brown. And so those students are overrepresented at Crossroads by roughly a factor of five. And Asian American students are underrepresented at Crossroads by roughly a factor of five. So roughly one-fifth the percentage of Asian American students at Crossroads as are in Valley View as a whole and at Pinnacle. And so that means that there's something about there's sort of something about this continuation school alternative education process that is placing more Black and Brown students at risk, that is sort of disadvantaging them. There's something about the way in which the district is dealing with students who are struggling academically, that is disadvantaging Black and Brown students. Because sometimes those students are struggling academically, not because they aren't strong students, but often I found it was because something was happening in their life. There was an illness in the family, or they missed time for some reason, or even just they transferred from a different district, maybe even out of state, and not all their credits transferred. So they had to go to Crossroads to get caught up with their peers at their comprehensive high school before they could actually start there. So it wasn't always the case that it was students who were flunking out who got sent to Crossroads. Oftentimes it was even the opposite of that. In terms of the culture at the two schools, So there's this sort of culture of what I call academic apathy that sets in at Crossroads because it's a concentration of students who are behind. And so what that means is there's not the same, even if you graduate from that school, you're not eligible to go to a four-year college because it doesn't have all of the courses that are required to get admission to those colleges. So students' opportunities are the military, working a low-wage job, or going to a community college. And those can all be fine options. Although in this district, those aren't really fine options. Those are sort of ridiculed and stereotyped and looked down upon as sort of, what happened or, what's wrong with you. So that was part of the problem. But a lot of students would go to Crossroads and start out working hard, but they'll have more opportunities at a school like that to, get involved with peers who aren't making good decisions, who aren't really focused on their education, who kind of lose interest because it's not interesting, it's not challenging, there's not a lot of programming, there's not a lot of, as I said, there's no library, there's no extracurriculars, there's no sports, there's just not that same kind of school feel that students really, really need. Students lose motivation in that environment. A lot of times the teachers don't really, the teachers aren't as into it because they didn't want to get a job at a school like that. There's sometimes the teachers are looking for a way out. They're looking to go to a different school. They're looking to move. So there's a lot of teacher turnover there. And it's not a good environment for students who are interested in maybe pursuing college. The students who are successful in that are typically the ones who kind of put blinders on and block out the noise and really focus, do homework through lunch period, work on recovering credits that way. But that can be a real challenge. There's a lot of distractions I found, and a lot of times at Crossroads, teachers' job was very different. At Pinnacle, teachers had the freedom to teach. They could teach whatever they wanted. The students were quiet. There were very minimal disruptions. If there were disruptions, other peers would kind of get their classmate in line, and it just moved smoothly. And teachers could really dig into material and really do the things they wanted, introduce new things, go beyond the curriculum in fun, interesting ways. At Crossroads, that didn't happen. Teachers typically had the job of trying to keep students on task, of trying to manage the classroom, which meant that they didn't really get the freedom to teach. I remember one student telling a student at Crossroads, one teacher telling a student at Crossroads, please be quiet. At least make me feel like I'm a teacher, because oftentimes they didn't. They felt like they were just managing the classroom. And usually it would only be a handful of students, maybe two or three out of the 15 in the class. But those two or three were able to really derail things and distract it for other students there who really wanted to make up credits. So it was just a very, very different environment. And I think that environment is created by the policies in the district that say that concentrating these students in one school is a good idea. I don't think it is. And, I think there's more that the comprehensive high schools, can do instead of having these alternative spaces that many times are just not the best environment for students to meet the objectives that the alternative school sets out to do, which is to get students back on track.
Thank you. So what would you suggest after conducting all of this research? What do you think would be some of the best ways or practices to combat these issues of inequality and segregation found in our schools?
Yeah, so I think, this case is a little bit different than some of the other literature. Most of the segregation that we see in public schools is the direct product of neighborhood segregation. Neighborhood segregation, in the research and the sort of real world experience tells us very clearly that residential segregation is the primary driver, and it's not even close, of school segregation. That's, for instance, why a lot of times school choice programs like we see in New York City don't really do much to integrate our schools in any meaningful way. Or what we've seen is when schools are relatively integrated, when schools are racially diverse, often they are segregated within. So there'll be what we call tracking, where certain students are in, more advanced honors and advanced placement and honors classes, and then other students are in kind of the regular courses or even remedial courses. And that's racialized as well. So we tend to see more white and Asian students in honors and AP courses, and we tend to see more Black and Brown students in the regular and in the remedial courses. With some exceptions, sometimes for English language learners, but for the most part, those are the racial disparities and patterns that we see. And so even in districts that are relatively diverse, where we see racial integration of schools, we often don't see racial integration of classrooms nearly at that level. This case is a bit different in the sense that Valley View doesn't have a whole lot of residential segregation. It's a pretty well integrated suburb residentially. The segregation here happens within schools in the form of tracking, which is widespread in this district. But the process that I describe in the book is a process of a more extreme process of tracking that's between schools. So it's not just having some students in honors and some in, you know, college prep and some in remedial courses on sort of a multi-tiered system, but it's pushing students to a completely separate and unequal school, right? That's the segregation part. That's the apartheid part. You know, that's the kind of separate and unequal education that is supposed to be unconstitutional in our country. And so I think that schools like Pinnacle that have the space, have the resources, should be responsible for helping their students who fall behind get back on track. You know, the reality is in places like Valley View, what we see is what I call the criminalization of failure. You have students who maybe fail a class and then they get pushed into a place like Crossroads that is very punitive. That's sort of criminalizing their academic struggle. And I think that's wrong. I think that's the wrong approach. I think that students can do, that the schools can do better by students. I think they owe students more than that. I think they have a responsibility, especially as public schools, to educate all students, not to sort of abandon them and give up on them. I think that's ultimately what's happening far too often. I don't think that it's malicious. I don't think that it's intentional. I don't think that they're trying to punish students. I think that the vast, vast majority of educators, whether it's in Valley View or other places around the country, really care about students and they really want to do the right thing. That doesn't mean that it's good policy. You know, that doesn't mean that it's good practice. And I think that the students would be better served if they were able to remain at a place like Pinnacle, recover credits there, not be socially isolated from their friends, not be isolated from all the extracurricular enriching activities that come at a comprehensive high school, like a Pinnacle, because the way that it's set up now, the policies and practices actually work against the stated mission. And I actually remember a student telling me it's a contradiction. You know, they want us to get back on track, and they send us to a place like Crossroads where there's like more distractions. And so we can't get back on track over here. And so I think that, you know, that's the fix. I think there's ways to make it work, to kind of give students that option. But I think, you know, having the option of Crossroads, it gives students like Pinnacle an easy way out. You know, it gives them a place where they can just send students, sometimes when they haven't even met their stated threshold, to recommend that they be sent. And I don't think that that's, kind of the best approach in this case.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Drake, for discussing your book. It's a wonderful book, a wonderful read. So I guess I have one last question for you. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm trying to kind of, get that stuff going. You know, it kind of feels like, I'm trying to like turn a cruise ship or something. You know, I've been kind of on this same path for the last few years for sure. But, you know, my interests as a sociologist are very much in race, ethnicity, segregation of neighborhoods and schools, educational inequality, immigration, and kind of the intersection of all those different things. And so I have a couple different projects that I'm working on right now. One is an ethnography of homeless students and families, experiencing homelessness in New York State, kind of in the Syracuse, New York area, and also in in New York City. The struggle, the highs and lows of that experience, and how, you know, we might be able to more effectively help those families. This has gotten somewhat worse over the course of the pandemic. But in most cities around the country, roughly 10% of public school students experience homelessness for at least some portion of a typical school year. I know that's a statistic that really shocked me a few years ago and made me want to investigate and do more to help, especially because oftentimes homelessness in children is often kind of out of sight, out of mind. You know, it's not something that we tend to think about. We tend to think about street homelessness, kind of adult street homelessness tends to be like what's in the news and all of those sorts of things. So that's one particular study that I have and that I'm in the early stages of. Obviously, as you might imagine, you know, being homeless and being a young person, being a student is very detrimental to your kind of physical health, mental health, and your academic opportunities and future. So that's an area, I think, of need that sociology as a discipline has not addressed enough. And the other is an ethnographic study looking at the refugee student population in central New York. Syracuse, New York is a refugee hub. A lot of refugees from the Middle East, from Africa, from Southeast Asia as well, and they have their own sort of challenges trying to adapt to the United States, trying to adapt to our kind of unique fascination with racism and with race and with racial identity. They're trying to kind of figure out where they fit within that. And also at the same time, they're trying to go to school and they're trying to understand. They're often the cultural brokers for their families at a very young age as they're trying to move through the system. So trying to understand some of their experiences and ultimately how I can be helpful in sort of drawing attention to these issues. So those are the two kind of projects that I'm working on right now. Working with a few after-school programs here in the city that work with students who are precariously housed or facing food insecurity or who are refugees. So that's kind of where I'm focusing my efforts on probably for the next few years, and we'll kind of see where that heads.
Wow, that's really important work that you're doing. That's amazing. Along with this book, and I'm looking forward to all of your upcoming works and research that you're working on. And thank you again, Dr. Shondrake, for speaking with me today.
Thank you.